Now more than ever. Lowe's knows you don't just want a low price, you want the lowest price. And with our lowest price guarantee, you can count on us for competitive prices on all your home improvement projects. If you find a qualifying lower price somewhere else on the same item, we'll match it. Lowe's, we help, you save. Price match applies to same item, current price at qualifying retailers. Exclusions and terms apply. Learn how we'll match price at Lowe's.com/lowest price guarantee.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, writing most recently about the Build Back Better legislation pending in the U.S. Congress by the Biden administration. There are many pieces inside this very large bill. Richard is writing about what we know about one piece to do with labor, especially with organized labor unions, and referring to the New Deal era, the National Labor Relations Act of 1935 and the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938. Both of them have acronyms, NLRA and FLSA. We'll take them one at a time. Richard, a very good evening to you. I learned for the first time, thanks to you, that the Build Back Better imagines strengthening the NLRA with by monetizing penalties if and when things don't follow the course. Now, my understanding of unions today through your teaching over many years is that the public unions are very strong and very healthy and prosperous and have enormous political advantages. All right. The private unions, on the other hand, have retreated into a hard shell. We could name some of them. They're very romantic unions. But is this present understanding in the Build Back Better addressed to both kinds, the small and hard shell of the private, as well as the large public unions that generally support the Democratic Party? Good evening to you, Richard.
Yes, hi. Look, I mean, this is a bill directed at private unionization, and it's an effort to try and take the National Labor Relations Act, which doesn't apply to governments. All of the public unions that you're referring to are organized under state law specific statutes, and the basic deal that they put together, which was never quite worked out or gelled, was we will give you the rights to collectively bargain, and you have to agree to waive the strike and accept compulsory arbitration. And so the major issue under that bill was a case called Janus as to whether or not the unions could coerce individuals who were against them to join their membership, and the answer the Supreme Court gave was no to that particular issue. The issue with respect to private unions is very different. And there, the National Labor Relations Act, created in 1935, modified a little by the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act, a basic situation in which if you had a union election in a given bargaining unit and the union won, it became the exclusive bargaining representative of all the workers in that union, whether or not they agreed with the union or voted for the union or not. And what they then did is they forced you to the bargaining table. What happened is if you decided that you did not want to bargain, what the consequences were that they could issue an order requiring you to do so and then reinstate workers with their back pay in the event of breach. Union leaders have complained for years that the remedy that you get in this case, back pay and reinstatement, is too weak relative to the risk at hand because it's a no-lose proposition to an employer. You fire somebody, you have to pay them back pay. Okay, it's not a very big deal. On the other hand, if you actually look at the employer side of this thing, they regard any kind of publicity for an unfair labor practice as devastatingly powerful. And for the most part, they take enormous efforts to make sure that they comply with the various rules of the law. But on the other hand, they also take advantage of the rules that cut in their favor, mainly those which allow them to engage in non-coercive, that's a kind of a term of art, speech, such that they can tell the workers by way of prediction what will happen if the union wins, but they can't threaten anything for what's going on. The unions have lost consistently under this structure over the last 50 years, not because there's been a change in the law, that has been remarkably constant, but because there's a change in the landscape. And there are no longer high tariff barriers that protect unions who can earn monopoly profits, say, in the automobile industry. Labor turnover has become much higher than it previously was. Assembly line jobs are much less common than they used to be. And it's extremely difficult to organize organize people who aren't on premises and who have various jobs that differ one from another. There's no economy of bargaining if the workers have constantly different positions. So the unions have consistently lost membership, and they have been unable to succeed even in this traditional plan setting because workers are now well aware. You put a union in place, the senior guys may get wages for a couple of years, but then the firm is going to go into decline. So in an effort to kind of coerce this sort of behavior, what the Biden administration wants to do, at least as a first cut, is to impose fines on firms that violate the collective bargaining rules. And these fines could be suppressed in terms of thousands of dollars, but in many cases the key issue is not only the number of dollars, but what counts as an offense. Now, if you have an unfair labor practice, is it one unfair labor practice? Is every worker a separate unit for this? Is every day a separate unit? So you don't quite know how these things are going to collate. And generally speaking, all of these issues are clarified through regulations on the one hand and through litigation on the other hand, but it's an enormous drain because if you start to bargain tough and they can do this, the cost of being found wrong is going to be extremely high. And so they hope that they'll be able to restore their unions to their grandeur. My view is they will get some progress, but much less than that.
And I go to one of the penalties, up to $100,000 for each discharge or, quote, other serious economic harm, end quote, and penalties of $50,000 for lesser offenses. But here's the twist. I didn't know this before. Imposing liability on corporate officers and directors for these violations. So not only the company will be punished, but the directors and the officers of the company will be punished individually, as I understand it, by the NLRB to be a violation.
Yes, remember, this is an agency which the Democrats in the short run control because the way it operates is it has five members when it's at full strength, and the president gets to appoint the chairman, and they have to be three from one party and two from the other. And given the utter split that one sees between Democrats and Republicans on this, you could be pretty confident there'll be a lot of 3-2 virtues. You also notice that you mentioned for each discharge. I think that would probably be construed to be each individual employee who's discharged. And then if you start figuring out what it means when you get rid of 100 employees because of a refusal to bargain, as it is so determined, all of a sudden you got yourself, you know, $10 million fine or whatever the number is. It's just very, very big. I don't think this bill is going anywhere. My own predictive sense is that the most that the Biden administration could get was the infrastructure bill, and that the opposition to this will be absolutely furious, even amongst moderate Democrats.
But it's on the table for further debate. And
yes, that's why. And that's why I wrote the column. I'd like to get it off the table.
The fact that it's on the table would, my reading of human nature, tend to inform the officers and directors of private corporations that there's something in the wind that you should start right now preparing for by not being tough-minded. Let's move to the other penalties that are in this bill. This is for the Fair Labor Standards Act. There are fines here because you don't meet minimum wage mandates or overtime rule mandates. Do I read that correctly? This is the individual workers.
That's been in the law since 1938. The minimum wage provisions are now receding a little bit because of the inflation, and the job shortage is rather systematic. But the overtime stuff is extremely important. And what happened is the Trump administration raised the cap. Above a certain level, you don't have to worry about this stuff, but below it, you do. And if you keep raising that cap, it turns out that there are more and more people who are covered by the overtime provisions, which is an extremely important feature of the law, because, again, the penalties can be extremely heavy.
The examples you give of what happened during these last years to call attention to labor relations is the Amazon vote in Alabama, where the workers, as I understand it, voted not to unionize, and the Volkswagen vote in Tennessee, a similar result. So is this bill, or this piece of the larger bill, is it designed to overcome that resistance that was demonstrated by the vote?
It's certainly designed to shift the odds. I mean, they may well decide to be very resistant, but it's going to come at a higher cost. I think the most likely reaction is that you will see anti-union campaigns being waged by employers even when there's no union on site, because what will happen is the ability to speak becomes much more compromised when there's a union in the office. And so firms will essentially try and give all sorts of inducements for people to avoid unionization before one appears on the shop. The strongest argument that employers have been able to have is a very simple one. You don't like what's going on in Tennessee, working at one of these Japanese companies, try your luck at what happened to the General Motors factories up north. And you remember, by 1975, there were 500,000 General Motors workers. When the company went bankrupt in about 2005 or so, there were about 42,000 workers. And union people, workers understand the fact that if you push very, very hard in a globally competitive economy, what happens is you're likely to risk the firm. And if the firm goes under, you go under. There's always a conflict of interest. You're always trying to squeeze a little bit more out of the lemon, but you don't want to essentially, to mix the metaphor, kill the goose that lays the golden egg. So how employers will respond, I think, will not be to simply abnegate. I think in some cases they will ease up, but I think they'll also broaden their influence and their efforts to cover earlier stages of relationship. It's a completely unhealthy situation as far as I'm concerned, and I think that the reasons why unions have failed under these circumstances, and if you talk to the Amazon workers, there was a very revealing column about this in the New York Times, they understood exactly why they were voting. They liked the health care benefits. They liked the fact that the firm was expanding in terms of the way in which it went. They had no confidence that the union, once it was put into power, would be a faithful steward of them in their various situations. Generally speaking, a union is a much more complicated arrangement than a simple employment, because you have three parties at the dance, not two, and one of them in the middle has its own interests, which means that it may not be a faithful agent for its principles. And workers understand that, and therefore what's happened is they become increasingly wary about the ways in which unions operate, and they tend to resist them. There have been efforts to try to strengthen unionization by voluntary means for the last 20 years, and the numbers keep dribbling down further and further. They are an obsolete institution in a highly dynamic economy in which job changes and job innovations are part and parcel of the landscape. Unions only work. We have relatively stable firms with long-term horizons, as was the case with the telephone industry, the steel industry, the auto industry, all the unionized industries of the 1950s, but all of them have changed the mix of capital and labor, the domestic and foreign production, the techniques of production, the ways of rules and management, their formulas for compensation. And in this environment, unions have no useful place to serve. And what's interesting is that's my social judgment, but even the workers, when they're asked the question, what you might be able to get by way of an increase in wages and better working terms, is it worth it to you to take the risk of a strike, to have to pay dues, and to run the risk that the firm will either shrink or close? And most workers make the decision it's just not worth that risk.
Speaking of Professor Richard Epstein, a senior fellow of the Hoover Institution who teaches law at NYU and the University of Chicago, unions are also concerned with the virus, the pandemic that still surrounds us. And when we come back, the unions, both private and public, are seeking the Biden administration to change its mandate. How so? This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART, or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.